Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, as you are, of course, aware, democracy is the very best thing that humanity has ever invented. And if you doubt that, just watch any sci-fi program from the last 30 years and you'll discover that the only reason you go to the trouble of conquering the immense difficulties of figuring out how to travel transgalactic spaces is that you can stand there wagging your finger at some tentacled mass explaining why they need to adopt democracy so they can have all their decision-making powers abrogated to San Francisco and they can have gay rights pushed down their throat by an Andorian president. However, I have found an academic who has some words to say to the contrary on this stuff. So let's get to the root of this heresy. I welcome Aidan Paladin.
Hello. Thanks. Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
No, thank you very much for coming on. Now, you are, I can tell, a proper academic, and I know that because I've read your latest Substack. And it's got things like confidence indicators or intervals, and it's got it's got the stuff, and it's got regressions, and all the sort of stuff that I'd like to be able to pretend that I understand, but really don't. So I'm not going to try. But you clearly are a proper academic. But are you one of the sort of the new age ones who doesn't do it in academia? You do it on your YouTube instead.
Well, I was in academia. I was a PhD student up until about, I guess, 9 years ago now. And I took a sabbatical from doctoral school because I was so burnt out from it. But I couldn't not work at the same time. And so my dad said, well, you're always talking to me about politics, so why don't you go yell into the void of the internet about it instead? And that's what I've been doing, is basically talking about politics and more particularly the intersection between politics and social science, which is what my background is in, specifically group psychology, behavioral psychology, and mass communication.
And that all lends quite well to politics.
Yes. I didn't intend to My PhD was going to be in game studies, studying video games and how people interact with video games. So very different sort of direction there.
Even that got political.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yes.
And around that time is when it started to get political. So, you know, 2016 U.S. election was a big change for everything in U.S. politics. And the most recent article I've written talks a lot about that shift, in part in at least the American political system. But of course, the Americanization of Britain is also, or Yankification has been occurring for some time as well, of British politics.
Well, one of the things I kind of got from your latest Substack, and actually I better get you to explain it in a minute, is that the system selects for a certain type of behavior. So whether it's the Americanization of politics or whether it's just that America is a slightly more mass democracy and therefore gets there slightly earlier, I suppose is an interesting question. But why don't you take us through what you're working on at the moment? Because that was what really caught my eye and made me think we need to have you on.
So basically what I've proposed here is that democracy as a system of government inherently leads to polarization and to partisanship. What we've found, I went through data that goes all the way back to the 1940s up until the modern day. And basically from the time that you cast your very first vote, you are selecting for partisanship. And once partisanship becomes selected, every subsequent vote increases partisanship every single act of voting. In the long run, what you end up with is people who are heavily partisan, no matter what their personal beliefs may be and how like cool of a person they are otherwise, when it comes to engaging with democracy as a system, they only become more entrenched over time, and very rarely do they shift sides. In addition to that, the other thing that increases along with partisanship is polarization on issues. And as issues become polarized, people start to see the world in completely divergent ways. You can give them the same article with the same information, for example, that Bush's statements on WMDs in Iraq, and then give them the Duflo report that says there were no WMDs in Iraq. And people who are partisan to the right read that article and were more convinced than before they had read it that there were WMDs in Iraq. And the same thing with Bush banning stem cell research for Democrats. After they read the article, they were a little bit more cautious on it, but they stuck to their original perceptions rather than coming to update it with the reality of the information. People, and they do this to avoid cognitive dissonance, which is a sense of psychological discomfort that's actually activated in some of the same areas of the brain as physiological pain. So, of course, as animals, we want to avoid pain. And so to avoid pain, we avoid political reality. And that's how people end up perceiving things so desperately. And by voting, it just gets encouraged again and again to not update your perception of reality and instead to live in a parallel one.
So I'm as likely to avoid slamming my fingers in the drawer as I am having to accept a political reality that does not concur with my priors, because it causes yes. psychological pain, which my brain basically perceives as the same thing and therefore avoid it.
Yeah. I mean, it's, again, having to admit that you're wrong sucks. Mm. No one likes to do that. And to particularly something that they've invested effort, time, money into in particular, the more you've invested into something, the more difficult it is to accept that you were wrong in the past. You either have to be wrong in the past or you're wrong now if the two things are dissonant. So your options there are to say, well, the present is false, or the present is different than how it appears, or to convince yourself that you really never felt that way in the first place. And particularly in the age of social media, where people have all these statements that they've made for years and years supporting a candidate or supporting a party online and readily available, I think it's even more difficult now to remove yourself and update your previous beliefs when it's all right in front of your own face and you're constantly reminded of things that you supported or believed in the past, if they're just concordant with current beliefs.
Okay, so this polarization is very much a feature, not a bug of politics.
Yes. I mean, you pretty much find this inherently with polarization. People have opinions towards politicians. And by polarization, it's often measured by things like the president makes me angry. That's what's meant by polarization. So these emotional reactions to politics. And what specifically we find is that partisanship alone in and of itself is not enough to cause this reality warping. It requires both partisanship and polarization for people to start to read things in the antithetical way to what they've just read or been informed about. And it's why I'm sure everybody has this experience where you've talked to someone on the left, for example, and they have a completely different version of events that they are absolutely sure is the real way that things are, and that you're actually the lunatic and you're the one living in a parallel reality. And that's the inherent result of voting yes. and participating in the democratic process.
Well, I don't know if I remember. Well, I mean, there are, of course, examples of that on left and right. But the way that I got that the strongest was over the COVID era, where I remember speaking to people, and I went to visit some people that I knew who were sort of terrified of this. And I had brought with me, because I was in crusader mode at the time, I'd brought with me the government's own stats on right. how many people were actually dying of this thing. And as to saying, look, your perception is wildly different to the government's own numbers. And they were accusing, and these were good, and these are people I know well, known for a long time, and they were accusing me of bringing them propaganda. It's no, it's right. literally the government's, it's because, and I could kind of see that the more effective my argument was, they were recoiling as if I had hurt them.
Yes, yes. Because it's causing psychological pain, psychological discomfort, to have to, because you have to do something about it. You have to alleviate the pain. That's our inherent desire is, well, I'm in pain. I need to make this pain go away. So you have a couple of options. You can admit to, or you can kind of erase the past and say, you know, maybe I was misled in the past, but I'm right now, or you're wrong now, but right in the past. That one's very unusual. The most common way of dealing with it is to do none of those and just ignore the present information. It's wrong or it doesn't exist. And that's what you find most commonly. And I think everybody can probably relate to that in some personal experience they've had, where just ignore, it doesn't exist, go back to whatever you were doing beforehand. And everyone is susceptible to this. It's not one political side or the other.
Yes. I wonder if as an investor, I'm somewhat insulated from that, because if that is the human tendency. But if you stick to it as an investor, you lose all your money quite quickly. If you can't update on the basis of new information, you kind of have to train yourself regularly to be able to throw out your priors. But I mean, presumably there are a proportion of people who can do this and do this.
Yes.
But I mean, you're talking about the sort of the mass of the voter base.
Yes. So there's two mitigating factors. One is political knowledge. So people who have who are political junkies, they tend to be less likely to be misled by and believe falsities because they have a general kind of baseline, people who pay a lot of attention to politics. Now, I should say that there is people who are eligible to vote are actually less politically knowledgeable than those who are ineligible, at least in the United States. That's been found. So they tend people who make voting decisions based on very little political knowledge. People, I guess, who are outside of the system. And I mean, in this case, it was measured by people who were under the age of 18. So 17-year-olds had more political knowledge than did 19-year-olds, for example, in the U.S. And that was over a long period of time, too, not just like one election cycle, over decades. So political knowledge is a mitigating factor. People with a lot of political knowledge who are political junkies, they tend to not be misled as easily, although there are, you know, examples of that as well. And that's probably because of the other factor, which is need for cognition. Need for cognition is the desire or need to think deeply about things, and it's heavily correlated with intelligence, multiple forms of intelligence, in fact. So people who are low need for cognition, at least in some instances, are more likely to believe falsities because they're dumb. I mean, it's honestly, like, there's no other way around it. They're a bit dumb. People who are high need for cognition, on the other hand, are able to discern these things.
But there are plenty of very intelligent people who just get locked into a worldview and never change it.
Yeah. So like I said, it's both. It's not just intelligence alone.
Okay.
Intelligence and being highly politically knowledgeable. Mm. However, if you're extremely partisan and the situation is very polarizing, even the most intelligent and politically informed person can fall victim to these tendencies to avoid psychological pain.
Yes. Do we think that this is a failure mode of democracy, or is it a mechanism that actually helps stabilize it? Because what you're describing is basically sort of creating two ballasts on either side of the ship that are very difficult to update and very difficult to move, which means that you don't get any sort of rapid change.
You won't get rapid change with this because these tendencies last for a lifetime. So like I said, once you've cast your first vote, for the most part, whatever direction that has been in, and even in a multi-party system, whatever direction that has been in will be the direction that you will stay on pretty much for the rest of your life, with rare exceptions, for the rest of your, you know, interaction with the political system. As a result, yes, even in multi-party systems, there's a tendency towards bipolarity. It's just one or two parties usually end up being at the head of that ship. And it creates, like I said, this two parallel worlds. If there was more than that, I think it'd be more complicated. But like I said, even in multi-party systems, people tend to diverge one or the other for the most part. And yeah, it perpetuates the democratic process in that there's always another fight to happen. We've always got to go face the enemy at the ballot box again and again in perpetuity, you know, ad infinitum.
So if most people, and I agree with you, most people are low information or low salience, whatever you want to call them, voters, what actually legitimizes democracy other than the fact that it's got all this psychological buy-in?
The thing that people mostly vote on is not policy, because they tend to be very unfamiliar with policy, and not just policy, but basic positions. What, you know, one of the more interesting facts that came out of this was that in 1992, basically in total, 35% of Americans did not know that Bill Clinton was to the left of George Bush. They didn't understand that the Republican Party was a right-leaning party. 35% either learned it or forgot or never learned it at all during that election cycle. You would think like the most basic bit of information that voters would be aware of, they couldn't grasp or hold on to. So instead, because people don't understand policy either, generally speaking, something between 10 to 20 to 30% of voters on any given policy issue either never learn it or will learn it and then forget it in any kind of election cycle. Over, there's about 9 different times that was 10 different times that was tested. And in every single case, it occurred the same time. People didn't understand or they learned it and then forgot.
So it sort of sounds like that what you're implying is that public opinion is it's more that it's produced by the system rather than expressing it.
Yes, it is. It's a product of democracy itself. So because people don't pay attention to policy, where are they getting their cues from? It turns out that the predominant and only real cue that voters base their opinions on is what I can best describe as vibes. So, for example, in the election between Al Gore and Bush, it was widely promoted that Al Gore was distrustworthy. He wasn't honest. He was insincere. And that was largely based on he did a speech where he talked about how his grandmother took the same arthritis medicine as his dog. That was not true personally. It was not a real anecdote from his life. It came from a House Democrat study. So it was like accurate information that the same medicine cost three times as much and was being prescribed to people and dogs. However, because he had lied about that, it gave his opponents the ability to just frame Al Gore as a dishonest liar. And as a result, that shifted massively favorable opinions towards Bush. And they didn't believe that Al Gore was less credible. They didn't believe that he was less intelligent. They didn't believe he was less knowledgeable. They believed he was less honest. And that is what shifted opinions towards whether or not he'd be a good president. It's vibes and not policy. The vibe stuff is what gets votes.
So I'm kind of thinking here that what you're suggesting is that, you know, early Donald Trump in particular, when he's in campaigning mode, was actually a genius politician because he didn't try and do all the clever stuff. He just came up with a nickname for people that was a bit cutting and a bit negative. And actually, that was not just a byproduct of his style. That was actually doing the work.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, Sleepy Joe all the other names he's got for everybody. Lil Marco.
Lying Ted and, yeah.
Right, yeah. All those little names that can reduce a person down into a single descriptor, which is always negative. I mean, that makes it much easier for the voting public to comprehend. They need sound bites because they don't have the time or energy to be able to. I mean, this is a full-time job, obviously. You and I both do this as a job. And most people do not have the time, energy, ability, whatever it is, or a combination of all of them, to dedicate to doing this as a full-time job. As a result, they need sound bites. They need little tidbits of information. And then it's a little bit absurd that we take people who we know are in a large portion incapable of learning these things for any number of reasons or forgetting them, and then expect them to go out and make informed decisions that determine the fate of the country.
It kind of suggests that actually what we're doing is it's much better off that you're not in academia, that you're on YouTube. And I mean, to relate a conversation I was having with Carl the other day, we were talking about running for parliament, but what we came to is, by God, what if we actually win? Because we'd be trading quite a powerful position as an influencer for a position of no power whatsoever, which is being sort of lobby fodder. Because it sort of suggests that actually the ability to express ideas clearly and simply and serve them up on a format which is low effort for people to get hold of is actually far more powerful than marching around in Westminster and waving order papers and all that sort of stuff.
Well, it's always a huge problem of being able, particularly for people in politics directly, to be able to communicate information to the voters, because they have this tendency to stick with whatever they originally thought or to learn it and then forget it. I mean, this was a huge problem, actually. Which election cycle was? Was it 1992 as well? One second. What was the actual 1997? So the 1997 general election, because Labour and the Tories had switched sides in terms of their position on, whether they should integrate with the European community, what would the precursor to the European Union. The British public was moving away from favorability towards integration. And so because the Conservatives had also moved away from being favorable towards integration at the time, John Major's whole campaign there was to try and inform the public that, look, the Conservatives are against integration. It didn't work, though. People maintained at the time in 1997, there was a significant portion of the public that continued to believe that Labour was against integration rather than the other way around. So you find this in all kinds of different political environments and contexts, not just in the US, but in the UK, in the Netherlands. And in my article, I talk about a lot of it, but it's so consistent. People can't learn new information either very well. In fact, it's been a problem with when newspapers make updates to articles, people will remember whatever they read first. and people will continue to do whatever they did first. It very common example, it's often people will say, my whole family votes this way, so I vote this way. And that's whatever you've always done is what you will continue to do. Very hard to break out of that.
Yes, and I know you went back to 19, whatever it is you went back to, but is this a fundamental truth of human nature, or is it perhaps the case that with social media, which is much less friction involved in getting hold of it? I mean, you can consume your news in whatever format that you want. When you're sat on a bus, you can pull up your phone. If you want to watch a half-hour Lotus Eater segment or a 90-minute Brokenomics segment or a 30-second TikTok, you can be served up in a relatively low-friction way. Is that helping to dissolve any of this, do you think?
I'm not really sure because the people who are going to be interested in consuming that content in the first place are the politically involved, people who are interested in political knowledge. And that is a certain subsection of the population. There's some stuff that, sure, has very broad appeal. People are obviously interested in the daily news cycle to a certain extent, just knowing, wanting to know what's going on in the world. But the people who are interested in politics to the degree that they will sit down and watch even a 30-minute segment, let alone an hour and a half, are typically the people who are already high political information and therefore less likely to be susceptible to this stuff. And also probably a little higher IQ, a little bit more at least need for cognition, need to want to think about things.
Yes,
So
that
unfortunately, it
describes our
does
audience.
echo chambery there. Yes, indeed, but that is it becomes a bit of a, maybe not echo chamber, filter bubble. People who select for it are already the people who are less likely to be susceptible to this stuff.
So is this why political systems in the West keep on evolving into basically technocracies? And this kind of layer of administrative governments, because if the signal, if there's more noise than signal going on in the electoral base as a whole, you can't really do it through the political system. You have to extract it away to the courts and the compliance, and Bank of England makes a whole bunch of decisions, and you basically just push it out of the political arena.
I mean, I think it has to sort of logically, because people don't know anything for the most part. I mean, these are what I'm talking about, the statistics here. These are broad national level statistics and surveys. On in aggregate, people can't, if in 1992, the American public, 33% of them, 32% of them, excuse me, did not know that George Bush was to the right of Bill Clinton, then there's, again, like a third of the populace. How can you expect them to have any sort of opinion that is informed in any way on details and specifics on bureaucracy and administration? It's just impossible. That's why it has to be someone's job. And unfortunately, once it becomes embroiled in bureaucracy and administration, it also becomes opaque and very difficult to then, for those who are interested and do want to know, find out what's going on or have any say in it. So.
So what are you saying? Are you saying that the system, the democracy is broken, or are you saying that democracy is simply optimizing for a different function, which appears to be stability over time without having to make much change? It wants to be the crocodile. It wants to go 300 million years without ever needing to evolve.
I mean, I don't advocate for democracy personally. I'm a monarchist, so which I think is a more stable system. But in terms of democracy, there is a stability to it. However, in that, these things stay stable over time. You stick with your vote, you stick with your party and your guy. However, because of the inherent polarization and partisanship that democracy produces, this means that the populace is perpetually at war with each other, which is not stable. And particularly in recent years, I think in part because of the advent of social media has exacerbated this because it's in everyone's faces all the time in a way that it used to maybe only be during election cycles, is that people feel that they are at war. I mean, for years and years, people like Tim Pool have been saying there's going to be an American Civil War. I've heard people say there's going to be a British Civil War for a while now as well. And a lot of that tension is built up because of democracy as a system, because people form marching lines and they're very unlikely to change them.
Yes, I mean, I suppose there is a way of looking at democracy, which is to say it's a proxy for a civil war. We used to actually have the civil war, and largely it was the biggest side won. But if you have a democracy, you can do away with all the bullets and stuff, and you can just cast ballots, and the biggest side still wins. But you didn't have to go to the bother of getting shot. So it's kind of version of that. But now, what I wanted to ask is, I certainly agree with all of this when it comes to a mass democracy. The only thing I'm wondering is, what is the problem? Is the problem the mass bit or the democracy bit? So, as a thought experiment, let's say the democracy didn't work where we all voted straight up to the national level? What if the way democracy worked is we voted for our local councillors on local things that we could actually have, you know, even low information voters can understand if their streets are clean or not, and if there's potholes and if the bins get collected. And then the local councillors vote for the county councillors, and the county councillors vote for the, you know, whatever, the MPs, and the MPs vote for, you know, whatever. You tier it up so that as you go up the layers, you're moving up the information level or the IQ level, yeah, whatever it is, of the people. Could that work?
I think that's probably more likely to get positive change to society. Mm. In particular, however, though, people are low information voters even at the local level. Currently, they're far more likely to be unknowledgeable at the local level.
If you enjoyed that content, and of course you did because you are a smart person, then why don't you go over to lotuseaters.com where you can watch the whole episode for as little as £5 a month, which really is not much money at all, and you get loads of really good content.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.